Don't worry. They aren't coming. This wave of power is contained to the valley, so far. Is the labyrinth still locked? It is not, Ethan said, grinning. Then we have to move, Lyndon said. This is our chance. The door swung open, and two blobs of color came in that Lyndon eventually identified as Mercy and Zeal.
My mother's... Oh, Lyndon's awake. How are you feeling?
How did you get here? Lyndon asked.
The whole clan's being mobilized, Mercy said. They set up a network of emergency gate keys to take people west to cordon off Sacred Valley. I snuck in, but Aunt Charity will figure out I'm here very soon.
Lyndon slipped away from Yaren and stood. At least his feet were steady, even if his vision wasn't. We have to go in. Now's our chance.
Go in?
Mercy repeated. There was clear hesitation in Yaren's voice, too.
That's a shaky bridge to walk. We're not ready to go into the labyrinth yet, but you want to head in now that a monarch's getting ready to slam the lid on the whole thing?
The suppression field is gone, Lyndon said. What do our preparations matter now? We'll have our full powers inside.
Not our full powers, Ethan corrected. It is the domain of Hunger Madra, after all. It will slowly chip away at us as we remain inside, so we should keep this to a quick operation.
The blob of white and black that Lyndon had determined was Mercy spun toward Ethan.
You're for this?
I'll put it to you this way. If none of you come with me, I'll head in by myself. Well, Lyndon and I will. This is a unique opportunity that we won't miss.
Yaren pondered silently, and Lyndon could practically hear her thoughts. She was skeptical about risking their lives for no reason, but then again, the labyrinth was a hiding place for all sorts of treasure. And if Ethan and Lyndon were going... Mercy turned behind her, looking for support.
There's a way to kill the dread gods in there?
Zeal asked. Lyndon nodded. Zeal sighed.
And I'm part of the team.
Lyndon nodded again. Zeal sighed again, more heavily.
And I still have some time left in my contract. Oh, well.
He walked out the door, leaving the other four of them behind.
I don't...
Mercy's voice shook.
I can't. Lyndon, my mother, if she shows up and we're still inside, she could... I don't even know. She could seal us inside, but it might be worse if she didn't. She'll have our heads for this.
There was something worse, something that no one had brought up yet, but Lyndon remained silent. Ethan slid up to his side and elbowed him. Lyndon shifted away, but remained quiet. Yaren looked at the two of them, leaning close enough that Lyndon could make out her face, and then she sighed as though she'd seen something in Lyndon's eyes.
What?
Mercy asked.
Somebody turned off the field,
Yaren said, speaking for all of them. Lyndon was certain that was the case, but he still protested.
It could have been natural decay after the damage from the Titan.
But it wasn't, Ethan followed up.
Someone modified the function of the labyrinth with intention. Now, they may not have intended to deactivate the suppression field, but they certainly intended to change something.
How do you know?
Mercy asked. Lyndon answered that.
The power shifted beneath the valley. Samara's ring is now fueled by different aspects of Madra than it was before. You could automate that, but there wouldn't be any reason for it. If it was just damage from the Titan breaking the field, then we would have expected to see the suppression weakening before that. And Ethan
picked it up.
If I was, indeed, sensing a disruption in fate, as now seems likely, then it must have been caused by someone. By every popular theory, natural cause and effect should not change fate.
Mercy let out a heavy breath.
How many people could get down there and make changes in the script formation?
I can't see anyone below Sage or Herald having the ability to both survive and alter its workings, Ethan said.
So we've got a real fight coming,
Yaren said.
Only if we go in, Lyndon said, fixing his gaze on Mercy. He tried to make his eyes clear. I've gone through an abandoned laboratory before, and I was alone. Orthos was too injured to help. We have a limited window here, and I want the whole team with us.
Mercy straightened, and even with Lyndon's compromised vision, he could see her brighten up.
We're a team? Of course we are,
Yaren said immediately.
Ethan said he and I would go in alone, Lyndon continued. But I don't want to do that. We've only got one shot at this, so let's make it our best one.
Mercy paced anxiously, tapping her staff on the floor with every other step.
I don't want to go up against an unknown enemy, and the dread gods, and whatever's in the labyrinth, and probably my mother.
That sounds like an adventure, Ethan said.
Mercy's voice was grim.
There's no way this ends well. No way. Even if we get what we're after and make it out, the monarchs will punish us. Do we all know that?
You'll have to walk me through how that's different than now, Yaren said.
That was a worthy warning, Mercy, Ethan declared. Let us count the cost before we dive headfirst into one of the most dangerous places on the planet.
Lyndon thought longer before he answered. He could easily see the monarchs taking a closer look at him than he wanted. Though that was a normal consequence of gaining more power. The higher you climbed, the more eyes were on you.
I understand, Lyndon said at last.
Mercy clicked her tongue.
Fine, then let's get going. Maybe if I'm with you, my mother will hesitate before she locks us all inside.
Or maybe she won't, Lyndon thought.
He remembered Malice's attitude toward Mercy in the Uncrowned King tournament, but he wasn't callous enough to say that out loud. Belatedly, he realized something he'd forgotten.
I should have let Orthos out. He needs to hear this.
Can't he hear every thought that goes through your head?
Yaren asked.
No, he just gets impressions. He's not Draws.
Lyndon realized something even as he spoke.
And we need Draws.
He had waited for the better part of a year. Draws was as stable as he was going to get. Lyndon had hoped for Draws to wake on his own, or for Northstrider to contact him, but without those things, there was only one thing he could try. Without waiting for anyone else, Lyndon opened his void key. He summoned a scripted box of stable, forged dream mudra that he had prepared. With his hunger arm mobile now, he didn't need his gold steel tongs, and he had prepared for this operation for a long time. Ethan's eyes widened.
Decisive? Best of luck to you.
You're not going to try and fix him here, are you?
Mercy sounded horrified. Yaren gripped his shoulder, lending him strength. He reached into his own soul and found the slowly spinning purple orb at the base of his skull. As he had done with his mother months ago, he projected Dross's internal structure into the air. Purple rings expanded until they spun in midair around them all. The largest ring was still thinner in one section than anywhere else. Lyndon took a deep breath to steady himself, and another. Then he grabbed a loop of dream mudra from the chest and, in one motion, fused it to the ring from Dross's spirit with a lick of soul fire. The change was immediate. Purple light flashed through the ring and then in the smaller rings around that one. It moved through the entirety of Dross's spirit in a chain reaction, faster and faster. Lyndon couldn't slow down his breath any longer. His heart pounded. The enlarged loops of dream mudra collapsed as Dross returned to Lyndon. Something was changing and squirming inside of him, and Lyndon couldn't fully understand what. Finally, the dream spirit inside Lyndon slowed and stopped spinning. Lyndon waited to hear something, but after only a few seconds, he could wait no longer.
Dross?
At the sound of that word, power spun out of Lyndon's spirit. A purple blob appeared in midair next to him, but it wasn't as dark a purple as before. It was pale and washed out, almost gray.
Ready to comply, Dross said in their heads.
Lyndon's heart stopped. Everyone stared at Dross in shock. Lyndon's joy overwhelmed his surprise, and he grabbed Dross in his remnant hand.
Dross, are you okay? Do you remember me?
Wei Shi Lyndon, Dross recited, adopted into the Aurelius family. You were responsible for my evolution in the Ghostwater facility and for introducing me to the monarch Northstrider.
It was Dross's voice, but just a dry and passionless recital of words. In that way, it didn't sound like Dross at all. Lyndon's excitement sank into his stomach.
How are you feeling?
My condition is functional. No significant abnormalities to report.
Collective sounds of disappointment went up from the humans in the room. Ethan placed a hand on Lyndon's shoulder.
His personality could still recover,
Ethan said sympathetically. Lyndon agreed, but he wasn't optimistic. There are adjustments we can try, but the more we change, the less time we have.
The labyrinth contains tools from some of the greatest soulsmiths of all time,
Ethan said. Good. We'll look for anything that might help. Lyndon turned to Dross and focused, the blur in his vision retreating for a moment. I'm going to fix you, he promised.
Unnecessary. I am largely operational.
Don't you remember what you used to be like?
I recall. My idiosyncrasies were left over from the component spirits used to construct me. They added nothing to my function, and I think you will find my operation significantly improved.
Dross's form was the same as before. One large eye, one mouth filled with sharp-looking teeth, and two boneless pseudopod arms. The only difference was the pale gray cast to his skin. But his expression was blank. He spoke like a construct reporting exact words. It gripped Lyndon's gut with grief, as though he'd lost Dross all over again. But there was still hope, so he kept his words clipped and straightforward. The idiosyncrasies were important to me, Lyndon said. If you come up with a way to restore them, tell me immediately.
Acknowledged.
A faint frown appeared on Dross's face.
I will attempt to reconstruct my persona in accordance with my memories.
You do that.
Lyndon looked to the rest of them, and he could almost see them. In the meantime, let's get ready to leave.
Not much to get ready, Yaren said. Got my sword, got my void key.
Mercy dashed for the door.
I do need to get ready. Give me 2 minutes.
Someone probably ought to catch Zeal, Ethan noted.
Lyndon was still watching Dross, looking for a shred of the individual he used to be.
I'll tell Orthos and Little Blue. In the meantime, Dross, what do you know about the labyrinth?
Information requested. History of the Western Labyrinth, Dross intoned.
But nothing happened. Usually, when Dross spoke like that, Lyndon's mind was taken over by a vision.
Error. Synchronization denied. No access available.
Dross shook himself.
I apologize. That was very strange. I will rely solely on my own memory.
That statement piqued Lyndon's curiosity.
Were you not always relying on your own memory?
I do not believe so. My apologies. My memories are more fragmented than I realized.
Lyndon renewed his resolve to fix the spirit.
What you call the labyrinth is also known as the Western Labyrinth, the Dreadgod Labyrinth, the First Tomb, the Forgotten Maze, and several other titles that may or may not apply to this location. It extends all over the world, but its largest, and presumably most central, hub is located under the land you call Sacred Valley. Records of its purpose and contents are incomplete and often contradictory. It is called the birthplace of the Dread Gods, but other claims dispute this, suggesting that it was a place where samples of the Dread Gods were studied. Records seem to agree that it was the birthplace of the lesser copies known as Dread Beasts. Studies refer to an entity sealed in the labyrinth known as Subject One, though this individual's true identity is unknown. Subject One is referred to alternately as It and He, implying it to possess intelligence and identity of some kind. He is always referenced in conjunction with Hungermadra, and is either its source or its first host. Inside, we should find creations of Hungermadra, as well as relics and security measures left by the soulsmiths of old, many of which will be extraordinarily dangerous. I am reminded of the Ghostwater facility, only I will have no map and no security access, and this location is known as a labyrinth primarily due to its impossibility to navigate.
As Lyndon absorbed this information, he looked over to Ethan.
How long will it take us to get there?
Ethan paused a moment before gesturing to the massive windows.
We're here. We don't want to head any further into Sacred Valley in case the field reactivates.
Yaren leaned closer to look into Lyndon's eyes, but Lyndon didn't acknowledge his own blindness. He was recovering anyway.
All right, then let's go, Lyndon said. Without the suppression field, we should be able to move quickly. The sooner we're in and out, the better.
With luck, they could move full speed in the labyrinth. They might even be able to make it to the bottom and back up in less than a day. Though Lyndon doubted it.
Yes, by all means, let us rush headfirst into danger, Dross said. There is no way it will result in all of our deaths. Ha ha!
The delivery was so dry and toneless that it made Lyndon shiver.
Dross, you can stop that.
I was emulating my previous persona.
I know, it's unnerving.
Acknowledged. Next time I will attempt a more accurate impression.
Chapter 9. Information restricted. Personal record 1126. Authorization required to access. Authorization confirmed. 008. Osriel. Beginning record.
The Abaddon didn't know what to do with Osmanthus Aurelius. Even his initial compatibility tests came back with unprecedented results. He had maximum potential in 6 of the 7 divisions. It quickly became clear that he could inherit the mantle of any judge, except one, Suriel. He had no compatibility with the Phoenix at all, as though his very existence was in opposition to the concept of restoration. Naturally, Osmanthus was not satisfied with these results. He dedicated himself to fixing, building, creating, healing, and restoring. He couldn't join the Phoenix Division, but he worked with them as closely as possible. He thought that surely his skill in crafting and engineering would be his pathway forward, but when that never worked, he branched out. He learned the arts of many worlds, took on ancient riddles, repaired governments and relationships. He lived for a time as a pacifist monk wandering the streets of Sanctum, though he quickly grew bored with that. No matter what he did, the nature of his origin didn't change. Not that anyone else from the Abaddon minded. Warriors and killers could both be put to work in the service of order, and if Osmanthus didn't want to bring death, there was always his other great talent of detection. The spider of the Abaddon works to find instances of chaos and disruption among the iterations, and to bind the Abaddon together with communication. Osmanthus joined his 3rd division and was declared the successor to Talariel in record time. In this capacity, he continued to have a special fascination with the Phoenix Division, as they were those who could do what he could not. He struck up a friendship with a woman expected to succeed the mantle of Suriel. She advised him not to ignore his talents. A true Phoenix would contribute to the greater cause of restoration however they could. He kept that in mind when he and his fellow spiders encountered a Vroshir trap. It was an ambush intended to wipe them out. The enemy had taken over an entire iteration, then cut it off from the way when the Abaddon arrived to investigate. Upon entry into the world, his entire team was eradicated. Except him. He escaped, but the disparity bothered him. With a weapon on the level of a judge, he would have been able to defend his team, but such weapons were highly restricted and forbidden to create. Osmanthus began to gather materials. He stole, unearthed, or recovered weapons of absolute destructive authority. Obsolete judge weapons, like the prototype razor of Suriel and the shears of a previous Machiel that had once snipped threads from fate. Weapons that had been used against judges, like the Bane of the Titan, made by the Vroshir to kill the 2nd generation Gadrael. Even the greatest weapons used by the Vroshir, Shairik, the Absolute Curse, and Octarius, the blade that sundered heaven. Finally, he added his own original creation, an improved version of Penance, his old creation, the Arrowhead of Absolute Death. He bound these together in the depths of the void, so far from the way that even fiends could not last long, in a zone of pure non-existence and annihilation. He forged them in the energy of a stolen world seed with enough power that it could have birthed an entire iteration. By doing so, he indeed created a peerless weapon, a scythe that would let him fight like a judge, but he did not expect the recognition of the way. He became the avatar of true destruction, the opposite of lost creation, and when he was taken into custody by the Court of 7 for his creation of the scythe, the court was in awe. Unwittingly, Osmanthus had achieved a goal that the Court of 7 had pursued since antiquity. He had manifested another absolute aspect of reality. He had become the judge of destruction.
With the exception of Macchio, who urged that Osmanthus be executed, the other judges agreed that Osmanthus should be given the mantle of the Reaper and raised up as their peer. He was even granted a new name. Osriel. Record complete. Back in the ancestor's tomb, Lyndon faced the door marked with the symbols of the four dread gods. He still had a headache, but his vision and spiritual sense had largely returned. In fact, this was the clearest his perception had ever been in Sacred Valley, now that the suppression field was gone. He could sense panic all over the valley. Their spirits were weak, and their populations were depleted, but they scurried everywhere. He could sense techniques of every aspect and path used from here all the way to the remainder of Mount Venture in the west, including a presence cloaked in light and dreams. Lyndon turned from the door to face Elder Whisper as the fox dashed up, five tails lashing.
"What have you done?"
Elder Whisper demanded. Mercy, Yaren, Athan, and Zeal stared at the fox. Even Orthos and Little Blue, on Lyndon's shoulders, faced him down. None of them were intentionally threatening. Athan was unsurprised at Whisper's appearance, while Little Blue gave a little gasp, and Mercy waved. But Lyndon could see the realization dawn over Elder Whisper as the sacred beast realized he was facing down a group of sacred artists far more advanced than he was. That must have been a serious adjustment to make after centuries of being the strongest in many miles.
"Apologies," Elder Whisper said quietly. "If you don't mind telling me, I would be grateful to learn what happened to the suppression field."
He was holding back his urgency, but he still gave a little dip of his forelegs in what could be considered a bow. Dross manifested on Lyndon's shoulder and spoke to everyone.
"This is Akura Clan territory. Legally, you are not obliged to answer him. In fact, with Akura Mercy here, execution would be within your rights as a lord."
"Why would I execute him, Dross?"
Dross gave a long, slow blink with his one eye.
"That was a joke. Ha ha."
Elder Whisper sank lower into the stones.
"Apologies, Elder Whisper. My mind spirit is not himself right now. We believe someone has tampered with the structure of the labyrinth, and we're going to investigate now. But we don't expect to return until we found Subject One."
Whisper's tails began to drift back and forth again.
"That's good. Very good. Gratitude. You have the key I gave you."
Lyndon produced the silver box containing the shriveled hand. Elder Whisper looked from the case to Athan's clothes, which bore the Aurelius clan symbol.
"I notice this one has the same symbol on his robes."
Only then did Lyndon realize they had never told Elder Whisper about House Aurelius. Before he could explain, Athan swept a bow.
"Athan Aurelius, at your service," he said, though he'd met Elder Whisper before. "I am a humble scion of the ancient House Aurelius, which is the symbol I bear. This key that you have shared with Lyndon was once the property of my clan's leader and monarch, Tiberian."
"Elder Whisper, we believe there may be someone else in the labyrinth," Lyndon said.
Elder Whisper watched the door carefully.
"I saw no one enter or leave this labyrinth since the attack of the Dread God, and several of these two curious children have tried. But I cannot guard every entrance, especially now."
"Do we have time for this?" Zeal demanded.
He had been dragged back from going off on his own, but every second he seemed more and more likely to walk away again.
"We don't,"
Mercy said.
"Then I will leave it to you," Whisper said. "Please do what I could not."
Lyndon focused on the door.
"I will try. Open!"
He felt weaker as his will passed out of him, but the stone carving slid inward. Zeal entered without hesitation, though the power emanating from within caused everyone else to hesitate. It was the same all-consuming hunger that reminded him of the void icon, identical to the aura that had flooded out the night before. Hunger aura. As Zeal walked inside, Yaren drew her black sword.
"Oi, Fox! How long does it take for a trip down there?"
"The labyrinth constantly shifts. The hand can allow you to reach the center,
and it is said that those who mastered its patterns could reach the heart in a day. Those I have known spent months or even years down there, and never reached the heart, if they made it out at all.
Yaren nodded briefly.
That's about what I would have bet.
She followed Zeal inside.
The Sword Sage made it out, Dross pointed out to Linden. But based on his records, he must not have gone very deep. He was also weakened severely enough to be killed by jades.
The suppression field is gone now, Linden said.
For now, and how much of his weakness was the suppression versus the constant effects of being fed upon by Hunger Madra?
The yawning mouth of the labyrinth was more ominous now than it had been a moment before. Mercy took a deep breath and dove in.
Where do you put our odds of survival? Linden asked Dross.
It's impossible to accurately calculate odds of survival without a statistically significant number of prior examples. Under these imprecise conditions, I would say that we have better than 50-50 odds of making it out alive as long as we retreat before we reach the bottom.
This isn't cheering me up.
Was that the goal? Then cheer up.
The complete absence of mirth in Dross's voice did not help Linden's spirits. Aethon threw an arm around Linden and began to walk with him into the labyrinth.
I believe we have all been appropriately cautioned against leaving this door open for too long, even more so since the field is down, I think.
Orthos glanced down at Aethon's arm.
You were eager to dive into this madness? What kind of plan do you have?
Plan? My plan is the same as it has always been. I planned to build up a team of those who can walk into situations like this together and solve the problems that no one else could.
Aethon took a deep breath as they crossed the threshold into the musty air of the labyrinth, then released Linden.
As long as we all survive this, no matter the outcome, I will consider this a successful team-building exercise.
Linden pulled the door shut behind them. The stone slammed into place, completing a script that suddenly flared white. Now they were sealed in. Little Blue burbled that she didn't feel well, and even Orthos grunted.
I think these waters may be too deep for the two of us.
Nonsense, Aethon said. Linden, protect them.
Linden had been about to open up the Dawn Sky Palace void key and hide them away when he paused.
How? The same way you learned to veil them. Let your will flow along the connection of your contract and extend it to them. Simply intending to protect them should focus the spiritual pressure of this place on you.
Linden did as directed, and to his surprise found it easy. Little Blue gave a relieved whistle, and Orthos examined one of his feet as though looking for signs of damage.
That's amazing, Linden said, sincerely impressed. How does that work?
You three are bound together on an existential level. In essence, the universe considers you connected. You can work your will through them almost as easily as you could through yourself.
Linden noted the implications of that, but the others were moving deeper into the labyrinth, so he simply nodded his thanks and moved deeper. This room was a long hallway with rows and rows of polished wooden cupboards. All of those Linden could see were closed and locked, but he felt nothing inside. He still investigated a few, finding nothing useful. Some had copper rings or wooden hilts, but whatever they had once been attached to had dissolved long ago. Linden recognized the pieces of what had once been sacred instruments, swords or spears or other devices that had rotted away. Mercy kept her voice low so it wouldn't echo in the long space.
We have some records of the outer layers of the labyrinth. This looks like one of the armories where the lord-level weapons were kept.
Linden's heart clenched at the thought of what they might have found, and even Yaren gave a disappointed sigh as she pulled off one of the doors and found nothing within.
Too bad about that field,
Yaren said in regret.
One Underlord spear would have ruled Sacred Valley for generations.
Linden suspected that the few good things that had made it to the Heaven's Glory School had come from inside this place in some way. Even if they hadn't once been hidden in these cupboards, random junk from the people who built the labyrinth would be treasures in Sacred Valley.
We should be deep enough to try the key, Aethon pointed out.
Linden wasn't quite as optimistic.
Let's get into the next room. He wanted at least one more layer between them and the outside world before they revealed Subject One's hand. He had to use his authority once again when they reached the end of the long hallway and another door swung open to allow them to pass. This time, the room more closely resembled what Lyndon had expected of the labyrinth. They entered a huge sphere of smooth stone with only three exits, the door they'd come from and two others. Over the door they'd come from, a symbol of a sun was carved into the rock. The other two entrances also had a symbol above them. One was a hammer, identical to the one on the forger badges, and the other. Upon seeing it, Lyndon's eyes shot to Aethon. So did Yeren's. Mercy gasped as she, too, looked to Aethon. Only Zeal didn't immediately spend to Aethon, because he had been the first through the doorway and had been staring at Aethon the entire time. The symbol over the second hallway was a curved crescent, and the ancient characters indicated great power, just like the Aurelius family crest. But there were two key differences. For one thing, the crescent was over the words instead of to the side. For another, the crescent was connected to a line running down the side. Now, it didn't look like a crescent moon at all. It looked like the blade of a scythe. Aethon's brow furrowed. "How unexpected," he said, in a tone that suggested it wasn't unexpected at all. Lyndon looked to the silver cube he held, which was marked with a symbol of the modern House Aurelius. "Aethon, did the Aurelius clan build this labyrinth?"
"Unlikely," Dross responded. "The ancient foundation of this facility predates the founding of the Aurelius line by at least several centuries."
"That it does," Aethon said.
He drew something from his pocket and flipped it into the air so that it caught the light, which shone down from a script on the ceiling of the circular room. It was his own marble, which contained darkness, just as Suriel's contained light. It had been passed down through generations of the Aurelius family. From Osriel, their founder.
"Osmanthus Aurelius, the original patriarch of our clan, was known as the greatest soulsmith of his day," Aethon explained. "Perhaps in history. That was his personal crest, which was eventually adapted into the symbol of our house."
"Did you know he'd signed his name down here?"
Yeren asked.
"I had hoped we'd see something of his, though I'm surprised we came across it so soon. It's my understanding that he left his mark on most soulsmith relics of his era all over the world. He was a busy man."
And Lyndon knew that he'd stayed busy even after ascending, becoming the Abaddon known as Osriel. Judging by the message he'd left in Aethon's marble, Osriel at least seemed to be an ally to Suriel, though Lyndon couldn't be sure about their relative ranks.
"Let's see what he left,"
Mercy said, but Lyndon stopped her by speaking. "We should check with our key first. Prepare yourselves." He had to calm his own spirit as he focused on the case he held. Exposing the hand before had been an overwhelming experience, and he was frightened to do it here in the labyrinth. Yeren's red-tinted sword arm spread out behind her, and Mercy shifted Sue into the form of a bow. Zeal opened his void key, which strangely seemed to take longer than usual, and withdrew his massive steel hammer. Aethon began playing with his pair of dark fabric scissors. Orthos cycled black flame, and Little Blue punched her left palm.
"Open," Lyndon commanded once again.
The silver metal bloomed like a steel flower, revealing a gruesome, mummified left hand of chalk-white flesh. Worse was the aura that boiled out. It made Lyndon feel like he was starving, like he was empty, lacking in every sense. The air warped, twisting like they were at the center of an invisible whirlpool. Even the walls bent inward. Everything faded, leaving the hand as the only real thing in the world. It was a fragment of another will, the strongest existence here, the pulsing heart at the center of the labyrinth. Subject One. Lyndon forced his will against the hand, controlling it as he would a construct. But unlike a construct, the hand fought back. Its fingers squirmed and lunged, trying to escape his grip, and a high-pitched howl echoed through the stone halls. The hand tried to command the labyrinth to take it away, to escape. But Lyndon was in charge. If it were the full Dread God, he would have stood no chance. Over a long separated hand, though, Lyndon's willpower won out. The fingers went limp as the hand gave up, and then Lyndon felt his authority expand. It wasn't the same as his relationship with an icon. It felt more like his bond with his remnant arm, like a new part grafted onto his spirit. Except instead of a prosthetic limb, it was a piece of the labyrinth. He could feel this hallway and the rooms ahead. He sensed the flows of power and which way led forward.
"This way," Lyndon said.
Then Subject One's anger crashed into him and he staggered. The imprisoned Dread God was distant and weakened, but Lyndon felt its will. It was furious that someone had dared to usurp its authority, and now it wanted to make them prey. The ground erupted beneath their feet. Gray-white Hunger Madra lurched upward from the stone, grabbing for ankles. They all reacted at once. Yeren leaped upward as her sword rang out, shredding the hands. Mercy's feet were covered to the ankles by greaves of purple crystal, and she spun her bow around her in a blurring circle. Pure Madra rushed away from Aethon's feet, brushing away the hands like water clearing away paint. Zeal simply let them grab his ankles, then forged a ring of shining green runes around him. A moment later, force crushed the hands against the stone as though gravity had been increased. Lyndon's attention was taken by the hand, but he still extended the hollow domain around him. A sphere of blue-white Madra pushed several feet out from his body, dispersing the spirits of Hunger Madra, including their true bodies, which waited underground. Around everyone but Aethon and Lyndon, bodies followed the hands. These were skeletal ghouls of Hunger Madra, their jaws hanging down to their chests. They howled as though trying to inhale their meals as they rose from the stone, lunging for everyone else. They were still outclassed. This was only a distant projection of Subject One's anger, a disdainful slap. The deeper they traveled, the more control the imprisoned Dread God would have. Everyone in the room handled the ghouls in a moment, even as Lyndon sealed the desiccated hand back into its silver casing. When the brief battle was over, Hunger Madra dissolved all over the room. Lyndon initially intended to collect this Madra to rebuild his arm, but none of this had been properly forged. These were effectively striker techniques given mobility and the faint will to feed. Yeren scuffed her shoe on the stone and spoke scornfully.
"Not much security. Recall that they would normally be acting against victims under the effects of the suppression field," Aethon pointed out. "They would be suppressed as well, but when both sides are down to jade, losing even a bit of your Madra can be deadly. Speaking of which, how are you holding up, Zeal?"
Lyndon had noticed the same thing. By letting one of the animated techniques touch him, Zeal had given up part of his power. The ghouls were some version of his own consume technique, so they would drain more than Madra. Zeal looked disgusted more than weakened.
"Lost a little Madra, a little soul fire, maybe some blood aura. Feels gross."
"One brush shouldn't be too bad," Lyndon said. "But it will add up. If they can move through the walls, we should protect ourselves." Glowing script circles appeared around Zeal's ankles, and he heaved the hammer onto his shoulder.
"Great. Now that we know what we're up against, let's pick up the pace."
Lyndon moved his spiritual perception forward, just like everyone else. It wasn't too far to the next room, and while he couldn't pierce the walls with his senses, he had no problem feeling the next room. Lyndon nodded. As one, the entire group vanished. From the other side of the continent, Malice felt power erupting from the Western Labyrinth. She sent messages to her forces arrayed all around the Black Flame Empire. She had people closer than anyone else. She'd be in control of the situation before anyone else could sense it and react. Not long after, her agents began speaking her name with intention. Their will focused on her, drawing her perception. She couldn't exactly hear what they were saying to her, she wasn't an Aurelius, but she felt their desire to contact her and the touch of their desperate anxiety. She abandoned Moongrave. When she stepped out of the way a moment later, she was within sight of Sacred Valley. And what she saw made her livid. The island of the Silent Servants, with its shining white tree, drifted just outside the eastern mountain, Both shared a white halo of crystallized light madra, though other aspects had been sneaking into the one around Mount Samara. Beside the northern peak floated the great ship of Red Moon Hall, the pyramid of Abyssal Palace rolled in on flying stones to the west, and a serpentine rain cloud held the storm collars to the south. The four cults loomed over Sacred Valley. Many of them still bore marks of their fight with Fury. Abyssal Palace had a huge chunk missing and was listing to one side, but their leaders were still in fighting shape. Malice's perception was somewhat blunted by scripts inside the Red Moon Hall vessel, but she thought she sensed red faith in there as well. These cults arriving so quickly meant they knew this was going to happen. They knew the suppression field script around the valley was going to be inverted, meaning they had one of their most advanced sacred artists inside the labyrinth. Maybe Shen himself. Instead of a desert of aura, Sacred Valley now gushed with power. But so much of it was hunger. Dread beasts would be born or empowered every second. The land around the labyrinth was like a slowly erupting volcano.
"I have to thank you," Malice whispered into the air.
The newly refreshed aura carried her words to the cults.
"It's not so often I'm given such a fine excuse."
She drew her crystalline bow and used its binding to forge a matching arrow onto the string. Air rippled as the fabric of the world was warped by the power she invested into the arrow, and she let it loose casually in the direction of Abyssal Palace. See if their herald could stop that. Even if he did, there were more arrows where that one came from. An arrow flew from the island of the Silent Servants, striking her own in midair. The collision of the two missiles created a thunderous detonation of light, which whipped up a hurricane and darkened the sky. Even the island was pushed back. Malice's mood soured even further.
"What a wonderful veil you have," she said,
and this time she didn't enhance her voice with aura at all. Miles away, a blonde woman in golden armor strode out onto the edge of the Silent Servant's Island. Larian, of the Eight-Man Empire, wrapped her knuckles on her own breastplate.
"Wish I could take credit for it, but I'm more about hitting things with sticks from very far away."
"So you have chosen to side with the beasts, then? Curious, I thought you liked being on the winning team."
Larian leaned on her bow, which looked to the mortal eye to be made of twisted gray driftwood.
"The human versus beasts line doesn't work without the dragon around, you know. It's not like all of us are human anyway. Besides, you know why we're doing this."
Her voice sharpened.
"The monarchs are the only ones who benefit from the system the way it is. It's about time we shake things up."
Malice itched to beat some sense into this short-sighted sage, but no one on the path of the Eightfold Spear traveled alone. Sure enough, seven other presences removed their veils all around Sacred Valley. The Eight-Man Empire was here in full, surrounding Sacred Valley.
"You think Shen is going to change things?"
Malice asked softly.
"He will never do anything that costs him power."
Larian shrugged.
"We're not like the rest of you. We don't need an ironclad plan before we'll put one foot in front of the other. Any change is better than none."
"Beautiful. So noble of you to be involved to change the world, and not for any sordid material motives."
"Malice, he paid us so much."
Larian staggered under the invisible weight of a fortune, only her bow keeping her upright.
"We were going to say no at first, but then he just kept bringing out more and more. I felt bad. I said, 'Rhaegon, how are you going to feed your people if you give us all this?' He didn't even say anything. He just kept dumping treasures into this big pile. Priceless art? Right under the pile. Gold? Pile. Scales? Weapons? Natural treasures? Pile. By the time he was done, I swear on my heart, it was taller than my head. Best day of my life."
Larian sighed fondly.
"So anyway, we can't let him down after all that, right?"
From the lands all around the valley, war bands of the Eight-Man Empire raised their banners. Not crude constructions of cloth and wood, but projections of symbols made of forged madra. Ghostblade, Nine Hands, Flame Gift, Blood Chorus. Each of the eight wandering mercenary armies that made up the Eight-Man Empire's workforce was arrayed against her. Malice had sensed them already, but without closer inspection had taken them to be the forces of House Shen. The war bands averaged one archlord, a handful of overlords, and two or three dozen underlords of peace, so only when they were gathered in one place could they possibly face down a monarch's forces, just like the Ape-Man Empire themselves. But this only stoked her rage hotter, because the presence of the Empire's armies meant two things. First, that Rigan Shen had devoted staggering resources to bring so many people so far. Second, that House Shen was still unaccounted for. He had presumably kept his own forces in reserve to defend his territory, but she would know soon. Her subordinates were on their way to the Rosegold continent already. Malice gave the gathered horde an icy once-over.
To think he would empty his treasury to bring such an army here.
I told you, he's invested.
Larian pulled her bow from the ground and gestured with it.
So are you going to let this happen, or do you want to make us earn our keep?
Miles behind Malice, the unaffiliated experts of the Wasteland received her transmitted message and removed their veils. Three heralds, a sage, and five ancient archlords. From the other side of Sacred Valley, Charity cycled her own Madra, and several herald-level spirits shone like bonfires as well, living weapons of the Akura clan. At a glance, Malice's own forces were lacking. She had fewer sages and fewer heralds. Then again, the Ape-Man Empire couldn't really be counted as a collection of sages and heralds, but as one monarch, and these were Malice's lands. Not only could she draw upon more forces than the enemy, she had other resources to play. And she could call Northstrider. Larian sighed.
I don't suppose you'd consider settling our differences with a series of duels, would you?
Malice tapped her bloodline legacy so that her eyes shone and she radiated shadow aura to blacken the sky.
Invaders, hear me. You have trespassed on Akura lands. Withdraw, or your blood will flow like water.
Guess the fight will come down to golds, then, Larian said. At least it is a good cause in the end.
Then she shed her casual appearance and adopted a manner more befitting a self-respecting sage.
Long sight!
The long sight war band, beneath their banner of a bow and an eye, gave a shout and a pulse of spiritual power that shook the ground. Far away, a different voice shouted, Ghost Blade! The Ghost Blade war band answered their leader, and another cry went up from another member of the Ape-Man Empire.
Blood Chorus! Flame Gift! Green Stride!
The war bands of the Ape-Man Empire sounded like the footsteps of the wandering Titan as they answered their leaders. And soon, if Malice didn't stop them, they would hear the Titan's actual footsteps once again. Rigan Shen had often claimed he wanted to call the Dread Gods together to destroy them and make them into weapons. Even if that were true, it would ruin her lands. So she would crack open this formation and destroy Shen's plans, even if she had to drown them in blood. Chapter 10. Lyndon could best describe the next room as a hall of hammers. It was a stone cellar, and very recently the walls had been lined with wooden shelves and racks. He had to piece that together, because now the room was strewn with splinters. Someone had clearly done battle here, and recently, though the stone of the walls was unharmed. Before that battle, the racks and walls of the room had been filled with hammers. Lyndon was certain only because some pieces remained. As they entered, he had to step over a hammer with a head that looked like it was made of dark purple glass. It still leaked sparks of pink essence from a crack. A pile of broken hammers lay in the corners where they had been discarded, and a few had been crushed while still strapped to a rack. Those same racks were all over the room, empty, and Lyndon noticed evidence that they had been occupied recently.
Dross, Lyndon said aloud.
Yes?
What do you think about this situation?
Lyndon had thought that question would go without asking.
This room was recently the repository for sacred instruments, all or most hammers. Most likely the intact instruments were looted after the battle.
Yeren nudged a pile of rubble aside with her foot.
Wake me when we find a room like this for swords,
Orvos had already hopped off of Lyndon's shoulder and started munching at a defunct hammer.
"Stop that," Lyndon said. "That could be 1,000 years old.
Orthos met Lyndon's eyes and deliberately took another bite. Ethan skipped to the middle of the room, then twirled in place.
"Ah, I see, I see. Well, this is a disappointment. This is all quite ancient by modern standards, of course, but none of it dates back to our first patriarch. They must have removed any of his relics when they first arrived."
"I know little about the Aurelius founder. You should tell me more so that I may form a more accurate picture of our situation."
Lyndon knelt for one of the hammers and ran his fingers across it. He could sense its mudra composition just as easily standing, but there was something more immediate about feeling it himself. "These aren't hunger mudra," he noted. He had hoped to find some materials to upgrade his arm here. As it was, he was reluctant to use the consume technique at all, since the binding was always on the verge of breaking again. Ethan slapped his forehead.
"Oh, that's right. I forgot we had neglected that aspect of your education. You see, these are soulsmith hammers."
Lyndon stared blankly around the room. He had used hammers in soulsmithing before. They were only used to physically batter certain stubborn types of dead matter into place, or to crack open a remnant's carapace. There didn't seem to be any reason to store a massive variety of sacred instruments for such a simple task, and all those that remained were broken, so there wasn't much else to learn. "Oh," Lyndon said. He stood, ready to move on.
"I hear from your lack of enthusiasm that you don't know what that means. Well, ahem. You see, there is a reason why hammers are often associated with soulsmiths, besides the use of hammers in more mundane smithing."
Mercy hopped from one foot to another. She looked between the three exits in the room.
"Yes, this is fascinating, but don't you think we could scoop everything into a void key and move on?"
Zeal jerked a thumb toward her.
"We can have a history lesson on the way. I don't know why we would. What do you have there?"
Orthos had pulled a huge pile of wood and debris away from the wall, then ignited a smoky red flame so he could examine something around the base of the wall. Zeal edged closer, and they both examined what appeared to be a barely visible line of inactive script.
"So this goes to the outer boundary of the room," Zeal murmured,
tracing a line of script with his finger.
"What does it do?"
Orthos asked. Lyndon longed to go over and take a look for himself, but Ethan was gesturing him over to the other side of the room to show him a mostly intact hammer.
"Once upon a time," Ethan said, "the tool you used for your soulsmithing was as important as the material you used. It was said that our patriarch could make a weapon fit for a sage with just his hammer and a gold remnant. The hammer is used to inject your will into an object, shaping its function according to your intentions. And each hammer has its own specialty, some being better for crafting weapons, some made for altering dream tablets, and so on."
Pink sparks flew up from the cracked hammerhead as Ethan spun it between his fingers. Lyndon examined it, intrigued.
"So what did this one do?"
"Difficult to tell now, but you can sense the dream madre as well as I can."
Lyndon had the vague sense that this hammer had once been used to shape memories. If he had to guess, he would say that it was made to alter dreams from their natural form, modifying them. As Lyndon looked over the collection of hammers, he started to understand, and new libraries of possibility opened up to him.
"I see. It's only useful to soulsmiths who can directly manipulate their willpower. So only lords."
As Lyndon was lost in the possibilities of soulsmithing, he overheard Yeren talking to Mercy.
"You think we should pick a hallway and leave them behind? We really don't want to get lost in here, but if we stay in here too long, that's what's going to happen."
Lyndon dragged himself out of his trance and snatched up the most intact hammers. He tossed them into his void key, which took a moment longer than usual to open. He would have to check its script. From his pocket, he withdrew the case containing the white hand.
"Apologies, I'm ready to go."
"It's a pity,"
Ethan said, as Lyndon readied the hand.
"I was really hoping to find some Aurelius relics here, but if there were any, they were taken."
Everyone present knew that someone had fought in here, and it was probably the same one who had deactivated the suppression field. There were no traces of the intruder's mudra left, or at least none that could be sensed compared to the leaking and broken hammers. This battle had taken place days ago, or maybe weeks. If everything went according to plan, they would eventually run into this person, so there was no point speculating. It was time to move on. This time, when Lyndon revealed the hand, all the uncontrolled power in the room flowed toward him immediately as the hunger devoured it. The hand twisted in his grip as it fed, and a howl echoed through the room. Instead of ghouls rising through the floor, this time strands of forged mantra, like Mercy's strings of shadow technique, shot from each wall and webbed up the entire room. In the first instant, they were all on their guard. Each of them dodged or blocked strands shooting out from the walls, and they ended up separated by webs of hunger mantra. For a breath or two afterwards, they all waited for the next part of the trap. Finally, Ethan cleared his throat. "I guess this one is free." The borrowed authority of Subject One pulled Lyndon toward the door on the left wall, so he sealed the hand back in its metal case before unleashing a hollow domain with a wisp of soul fire. The blue-white sphere filled the room, wiping out all the hunger mantra. Each strand resisted a little, holding a small amount of will behind it, but the entire room was clear in a moment.
"Ten scales, if somebody can tell me what the point to that technique was," Yaren said.
"I don't think that was a conscious attack," Lyndon responded. It was just a gut feeling, but he thought he was probably right. Or if those grunted.
"It feels like something stirring in its sleep. I don't like it."
Little Blue shuddered as she made a tinkling sound in agreement, snuggling closer to Lyndon's neck.
"I suspect these are indeed instinctive defensive reactions," Ethan said. "Like scratching at an itch while you sleep. But attacks of this level would never trouble someone like the Sword Sage, even taking the suppression field into account."
Zeal pushed himself up from the ground, rolling up a tiny scroll. He had copied some of the runes himself.
"It's definitely going to get stronger. Let's get deeper while we're still fresh."
"Thank you," Mercy cried. "Whatever we do, we need to move."
Lyndon nodded and led the way to the tunnel the hand had indicated. Until the tunnel vanished. He sensed something, and it felt similar to the substance he pushed through to create a portal, like he was feeling the fabric of space itself. Now there was only a blank stretch of wall where a tunnel had been a moment before. Everyone except Lyndon and Ethan put their guard up at the sudden shift, including Little Blue. Lyndon looked around for the entrances. If they had all vanished, they were going to need to find a way to break through this stone before they died here. There were still two entrances left. The hall they'd come from had vanished, just like the one they had been headed into. Now there was one entrance against the right wall, and one in the ceiling. The ceiling tunnel was marked with the image of a coiled, serpentine dragon, and the entrance in the right wall bore another symbol of the Aurelius Patriarch. Zeal leaned against his hammer and sighed.
"They can manipulate space. Great. I should have known."
"Think of it this way," Ethan said. "We have so much to learn."
Once more, Lyndon brought out the hand. In the headquarters of the Twin Star Sect, on the edge of Serpent's Grave, Jialong completed his morning cycling. This aura chamber was perfect for him, having once belonged to the Jai clan. It was filled with glowing blades that saturated the air with the power of light and swords. He couldn't replenish the animating force of the snake that brought all his techniques to life, but that resource seemed inexhaustible. Jialong only wished it would one day leave his mantra, no matter that his entire fighting style was now based around it. He wrapped the bands of scripted red cloth around his face with practiced motions before he unlocked the chamber door and found Wei Shi Kelsa waiting for him on the other side. Just like the rest of her family, she was tall and intense, but where Lyndon tended to look like he was contemplating a murder, Kelsa gave off the impression that she was always giving you 100% of her attention, no matter what was happening.
"Kelsa, is something wrong?"
"I thought you might want to train together,"
she said. A fox's tail of purple-white foxfire lashed behind her. Her gold sign. She saw him glance at it, and her gaze darkened.
"I still hate it."
"It could be worse," Jialong said.
"It's not practical, even if it can burn people.
Snow foxes have claws and teeth. I could have gotten those.
Jai Long began to walk away from the stellar spear aura chamber, and she fell into step beside him. As every morning, there was a decent-sized crowd on the path leading to the various aura chambers. Morning cycling was a common practice.
Not every gold sign is practical.
Why not? It isn't fair that some people should have extra weapons growing from their body, while others have useless decorations.
Even without gold signs, some people have longer reach with their swords or learn techniques faster. The world isn't fair.
Jia Long had bitterly resented the unfairness of gold signs for years, so he had accepted the truth of it more thoroughly than anyone else. Kelsa scowled about it, though she didn't argue. It was a mark of her familiarity with him that she was complaining about this to his face at all. Shortly after her advancement, she hadn't said a negative word about his gold sign for fear of offending him. He didn't mind. If anything, having the worst gold sign in the world made him empathize more.
You didn't answer me, she said abruptly. Do you want to train together?
Why do you have to make it a formal invitation? It doesn't make much difference if we train together or separately.
There was enough of a gap in their advancement, and enough of a difference in their paths, that there weren't many benefits they could offer one another.
It's romantic, she responded.
Jai Long missed a step, but she gave him a confused look.
What? I told you I was interested in you.
People don't normally do that, he said.
Not just say exactly what they meant with zero subtlety, but also express interest in him. No one had done that since he had botched his advancement to low gold when he was a child.
Most people like to waste time.
Jai Long had a knot of complicated emotions to untangle, but he knew how to control himself under pressure, and he was interested, potentially.
If you wanted to spend some time together, we don't have to train. There's a new...
What do you mean? She interrupted. Training together is romantic.
Jai Long stared blankly at her. Training was boring and repetitive work. As he did, he felt a light touch brush across his perception, and he realized there had been a web of Madra strands observing him for a while. He glanced to his left and saw his sister smiling as she walked up to him. Fingerling was coiled onto her shoulder. She dipped her head as she reached Kelsa.
Apologies,
Jai Chen said, which made Jai Long think they'd been around the people of Sacred Valley for too long.
I didn't mean to eavesdrop.
Kelsa looked from her to Jai Long, studying his eyes.
Your brother doesn't think training together is romantic.
It isn't, he said.
Jai Chen, what do you think?
His sister cuffed her chin and gave the question far more consideration than it deserved.
I could see that, I think. It's personal, intimate, one-on-one. You'd have to be with the right person, though.
Kelsa looked to him triumphantly, but now he only thought they were both crazy. He may have been out of his depth with this subject, but he had observed others. Training was just work. Unwittingly, he thought of Linden, the 20-year-old sage who used his free time to train more. Maybe something ran in the family. Jai Chen gave a sharp gasp, and he immediately stretched his perception out to her. Even with the support of his sect, she'd had a difficult time reaching low gold. There weren't any remnants with her unique blend of aspects, not to mention any appropriate scales. But since she had, her detection web had become easier to use and far more efficient. As a true gold, his spiritual perception was naturally far beyond hers, but she could sense physical changes far faster than he could. It didn't take long before everyone saw what she had. A thin pillar of shadow stretched into the sky behind Jai Long. He couldn't feel it with his perception. It was veiled somehow, or maybe just beyond his ability to detect, but he certainly felt the power of the one stepping through it. Underlord. So this was a portal of some kind. Without discussion, the three pushed toward the black beam stretching into the sky. Of course, they weren't the only ones. And a moment later, that was proved unnecessary, as a true gold woman in the green armor of the Sky Sworn drifted up on a 1,000-mile cloud. The Underlord, whoever it was, remained on the ground. A green construct flashed in front of the Sky Sworn's mouth, and her voice echoed over the crowd.
By the order of the Black Flame Emperor, and with the support of the Ikora clan, every combat-capable sacred artist of low gold or higher is commanded to report to the Skysworn immediately for inspection and possible transfer to battle.
Jai Long felt a chill. The Pillar of Shadow was still there, which meant they might see combat today. A small army of clerks and administrators from the Black Flame Empire was flooding out of the portal now, already shouting orders and organizing those they could reach. He straightened his spine.
Stick with me. They'll evaluate us together.
He was certain the other two wouldn't pass the Empire's examination. They were both newly advanced to low gold. Neither were ranked on any of the combat lists, and they both had paths better suited to support. It was easy for those in a large clan or powerful sect to forget, but most sacred artists were not dedicated to combat and advancement. A practitioner of illusion techniques, like the Path of the White Fox, was far more common as a teacher, artist, or messenger than a fighter. Not only was raising a real warrior a commitment of time and difficult training, but it was expensive. As expected, most of the low golds, and even a large chunk of the high golds, he saw lined up in front of the Black Flame clerks were quickly turned away. But not as many as he expected. It was an hour before they were seen, and Jai Long didn't even get an examination. A low gold sensed his power and the soul fire in his spirit, bowed, and presented him with a chip of cheap metal that had Peak True Gold stamped on it.
Sect, school, or clan? The clerk asked.
He was respectful, but it had the tone of a question he'd asked 1,000 times already.
Sect of Twin Stars, Jai Long said.
Those words sounded strange to his own ears. The clerk dutifully marked it down before asking for his name, age, and path.
As a Peak True Gold, you'll be a squad leader, the clerk explained. Wait in the designated area for your squad to be assigned to you. It's usually 3 high golds and 5 low golds, but it depends on who we get.
Jai Long saw a squad matching that description pass into a nearby tent from which no one had returned. Another portal, presumably.
Loading us out quickly.
Emperor's orders.
The clerk clearly wanted him to move on, but Jai Long looked over to Jai Chen and Kelsa, who were being examined nearby. A woman was poking Fingerling with a drudge shaped like a spiky ball while a man watched Kelsa demonstrate her techniques. Jai Long pointed to one, then the other.
That is my sister, and she's not a fighter, so I want her off the list. That one is, but she's an illusion artist, so I want her in my squad.
The clerk scribbled a note.
If your sister passes the examination, she'll be fighting, I'm sorry. But I can arrange to have them both assigned to you unless there's someone higher ranked who wants them.
Underlords won't be fighting over low golds.
The clerk, a low gold himself, chuckled nervously at the words of a Peak True Gold.
Heavens, no, that's true.
Where are we fighting?
As expected, the clerk didn't know. To Jai Long's dismay, his sister passed the examination as a fighter, as did Kelsa, but he had expected that. If she had claimed to be an entertainer, or even lamplighter, they would probably have believed her, but she would have certainly asked to fight. He was assigned 3 high golds and another pair of low golds. At first scan, none of them were impressive. But they all stood stiffly and silently as he watched them, frightened of his attention. Except for his sister, who looked terrified, just not of him, and Kelsa, who scanned the situation herself with unrelieved intensity.
Can we not tell our families where we're going?
She asked him, voice low.
You can leave a message with one of the clerks,
Jai Long told her.
But I've never seen anything like this before. If it's such an emergency, why do they need so many low golds?
This kind of rushed recruitment reminded him of a clan scraping up all its disciples to defend against a sudden raid, but that was only necessary when the experts were already occupied. The Emperor, an overlord, could obliterate every gold here with a wave of his hand. Which meant that, wherever they were headed, the most advanced sacred artists were either absent or countered. Their squad was waved through quickly, and he found them ushered into a tent taken up almost entirely by a shimmering doorframe that led onto another bustling camp far away. He couldn't tell how far, but the woman sweating and loading scales into the doorframe was an underlord. And she wasn't forging the scales either.
They were coming from a scripted case at her side, and the madra shining from the purple-black scales was so intense that he had to close off his spiritual sense. A Trugold attendant waved them through, and as the leader and most advanced member of his party, he stepped through first. His heart dropped in an instant. Even surrounded by a crowd of strangers, he recognized where they were immediately. The trees were black, the buildings were temporary, and the mountain looming in the far distance had a halo around its peak. "We can't get away," Jialong muttered. "There is no escape." They were heading back to Sacred Valley. This time, when the labyrinth shifted, the tunnel opened over Linden's head and pointed straight upward. There was no ladder, but it wasn't as though Linden needed one. He and Yeren leaped. They didn't know exactly how high it was, but it didn't matter much. If they started running out of momentum, they could leap off the walls. It didn't come to that. Linden's jump carried him into a huge, empty room that reminded him of an arena. Yeren hit the ceiling, far overhead, and had to push off. Orthos grumbled about the trip and demanded that Linden put him down, while Little Blue cheered at the thrill. Mercy was right behind them, pulling her way up with strings of shadow, and Zeal hopped up on disks of forged runes. To Linden's surprise, the last one up was Aethon. He pulled himself up the last few feet rather gracelessly, but he salvaged it by striking a pose when he made it all the way up. "This isn't fair," he said. "You all know enforcer techniques are my weakness. That and fine imported silk."
"These weaknesses have been logged for future reference," Dross said dutifully.
Aethon looked startled. Linden had already started glancing around the room. What he had first taken for rows of seats were coffins, each carved with the image of a dragon. They were all very different in appearance, from four-legged dragons with wings spread to serpentine dragons with claws, and each was set with colored gemstones that would likely have matched what color the dragon was in life. He sensed very little power coming from inside any of these coffins, but several had been opened, presumably to remove any treasures. He glanced inside, just in case, but found only a dragon skeleton. Zeal only examined the script circles around the room for a second before he said, "Death aura." Linden had assumed as much. There were only a few reasons to collect corpses in a place like this labyrinth, and honoring the dead was probably the least likely. This had once been the place to generate death aura and funnel it away to some project. Though, like all the other aura in the place, it had been consumed by hunger. Linden started to open the hand, ready to move on, when Aethon stopped him.
"There's no exit," Aethon pointed out.
Linden saw he was right. The only way out was the entrance through which they'd come.
"All right," Mercy said. "Back down."
She made as though to leap down the hole, but Linden had unraveled the case around the hand already. Hunger filled the room, and he sensed immediately where to go. It was a hallway sealed behind a blank stretch of wall. No enemy techniques struck at them this time, but it still left them in a quandary. Yeren sat down immediately, arms crossed.
"Bet my sword against a fingernail, there's about to be a door there."
Mercy took several deep breaths, calming herself.
"You're right. I know you're right, but we're going so slow."
"I'm just as worried about going too fast," Linden said. "We want to know what we're walking into." He didn't mind the chance to explore the room some more, so after packing away the hand, he immediately checked the entire room by looking to Aethon. Instantly, Aethon pointed to a corner of the room.
"An unfortunate previous explorer. Left some records. Could be a map."
Linden crossed the space in one leap, landing on the highest tier around the outside wall. A skeleton huddled there, in between heavy stone coffins that had been dragged around to make a makeshift fortress. Old scripts had been painted around him, though they were faded with time. Orthos scurried up to the skeleton, pulling out a scrap of paper that had been tucked away in the would-be tomb robber's clothes. Linden focused his perception on the rest of the body, trying to sense anything with even a trace of power, but either the years or other explorers had taken everything of value. Meanwhile, Orthos was reading the paper.
He was writing a warning to a team coming after him,
Orthos rumbled.
He warns against a guardian. He says it has powers beyond his understanding, and calls it a baby dread god, the Tomb Hydra.
Unwilling to rely solely on his spiritual sense, Lyndon had been flipping through the dead man's pockets with his hand. After he flipped open the front of the man's robes, his fingers stopped. The skeleton was wearing a badge, a white badge. Unlike Lyndon's, this one was carved with the symbol of a cloud, but quick inspection revealed this to be wintersteel-plated bronze. If Lyndon understood Athan's history lesson correctly, that meant this man had been a sage. Orthos snorted smoke over the document.
His power was weighed down by the field. We won't be as weak as he was.
Lyndon hesitated, halfway between pocketing this badge. Had Orthos not seen it? Did he not realize how advanced this sacred artist had been? Orthos.
I saw it,
the turtle said. Lyndon nodded and slipped the badge into his pocket. There was no need to ask if Athan had seen it. Indeed, the Archlord was already calling out to the rest of the room.
It seems we're about to reach a guardian known as the Tomb Hydra, powerful enough to cause a sage to tremble in fear and likened to a dread god. Probably not without cause, given that somewhere in here is the birthplace of the dread gods. Who's frightened?
Lyndon wished he had his right arm at full capacity, but he wasn't frightened. Mercy shrugged. Yeren brightened, her crimson eyes sparkling.
You're thinking we get a real fight.
The suppression field worked on everything, Zeal pointed out. It shouldn't be able to take us at full power unless it's a real dread god. Then we're dead.
Dross materialized in front of Lyndon again, his color still too pale and washed out.
It is good to be optimistic. You will perform better if your spirits are up. But defeat here is not the greatest risk. We should consider the fact that any Madra or Soulfire we expend in this battle will be difficult, if not impossible, to replace. Our power is finite.
Everyone grew more grim, except Athan, who beamed at Dross.
Thank you for reintroducing some tension to the situation, Dross.
You're welcome. Ha ha.
The fake laugh told Lyndon that Dross thought he'd told a joke, but Lyndon wasn't sure which part the joke was supposed to be. Space shifted again, and suddenly there was an opening in front of Yeren. She shot to her feet as deadly green-black aura blew out of the tunnel like a toxic wind. It battered at her lifeline, but Lyndon wasn't concerned about her. She was a herald now. Aura of this level wouldn't be able to touch her unless she lived in it for years. He was more concerned for Mercy, and he moved to stand in front of her. He reinforced his protection of Orthos and Little Blue as he did so. Mercy gave him a grateful smile.
Thanks. I can handle it for a while, but I'd rather be in combat shape.
Lyndon nodded back and headed into a tunnel marked with a pair of crossed swords and toward the monster that waited there.
Good thing it hasn't attacked us yet,
Athan shouted. It immediately attacked. Chapter 11. From deep in the tunnel that crawled with death aura, a beam of pale, sickly green light blasted toward Lyndon and the others. It tore through the air, filled with malevolent willpower, pressing heavy against Lyndon's sage senses like one of the wandering titan's casual attacks. Everyone had techniques ready to defend themselves, but Yeren met the attack first. She stood in front, her scarlet sword arms extended, the black